From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Amadou's blood will feed the battle for justice for everyone in this life.
I did nothing wrong, and this trial will show that I did nothing wrong, and I'm looking forward to it.
Four white police officers are charged with second-degree murder for killing Amadou Diallo. And remembering Samori Marksman, a dear colleague at Pacifica Radio.
No elected official has the courage to stand up and say, I'm a socialist. Or I'm an anti-imperialist. In fact, the last person of prominence to declare that they were an anti-imperialist was Mark Twain. And that's when they officially declared him crazy.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. CNN reports that NATO has confirmed that the three soldiers being shown on Serbian TV are the three who disappeared near the Yugoslav-Macedonia border on Wednesday. NATO plans a news conference today in Brussels. Meanwhile, Russian President Boris Yeltsin wants his foreign minister to meet with the top diplomats from the G7 nations to discuss a halt to NATO's attacks on Yugoslavia. But since six of the world's seven leading industrial nations are taking part in the attacks, such a meeting appears unlikely. NATO yesterday opened its expanded bombing campaign against Yugoslavia, and alliance officials said they were planning weeks of airstrikes intended to undermine President Slobodan Milosevic's hold on power. The stepped-up bombing of a broader range of sites as the second week of airstrikes begins is intended to give the alliance a more effective tool to press Milosevic to halt the Serbian onslaught in Kosovo. This, according to NATO officials. NATO plans to bomb throughout Yugoslavia, with some exceptions, and the alliance's military commanders are quick to use their expanded authority. There's another big merger in the oil industry. BP Amoco says it's acquired Atlantic Richfield for more than $26 billion in stock. BP Amoco says it expects to eliminate some 2,000 jobs, mostly in the United States. The merger would create the world's second biggest oil company. In Laramie, Wyoming, the first phase of jury selection is over in the trial of a man charged with beating a gay college student to death. 21-year-old Russell Henderson is charged with first-degree murder, kidnapping, and aggravated robbery in Matthew Shepard's death last October. An alleged accomplice, Aaron McKinney, has yet to be tried. The final panel of jurors will be chosen on Monday. Opening statements are expected on Tuesday. The White House says that 92% of the federal government's essential computer systems are ready for the year 2000, but predicts Americans will have some difficulty reaching some foreign countries by telephone on January 1st because some computers overseas will not be fixed in time. General Barry McCaffrey, director of the Clinton administration's Office of National Drug Control Policy, says his opposition to the growing of hemp in the United States is softening. Hemp is a non-intoxicating look-alike cousin of marijuana that's grown for fiber, seed, and oil. It's banned in the so-called war on drugs, but farmers are fighting for the right to grow it. Kenneth Kaunda, the father of modern Zambia and the country's president for 27 years, was declared a stateless person by the country's high court today. Ruling on a case brought by high-ranking members of the present governing party, the court ruled that Kaunda is not a Zambian citizen under the Constitution because his parents are from the nation now called Malawi. The president-elect of Nigeria says he's not listening to critics who say a legacy of corruption will hinder the development of democracy in Nigeria. On Tuesday, he met with President Clinton, promising that Nigeria's military would become more professional and would remain under civilian control. This news from Atlanta, Georgia. A white customs supervisor at the Atlanta airport was replaced with a black supervisor after the agency was accused of unfairly singling out black travelers for searches, this according to an inspector. Dale O'Connor, the white supervisor of the 16-member passenger inspection team, was transferred to the cargo inspection division. A former Baptist minister was sentenced to 5.5 years in prison after being convicted of swindling $4 million while president of the National Baptist Convention USA, including donations to rebuild black churches burned in the South. Henry Lyons has also been ordered to repay $2.5 million. The Iraqi regime most likely killed a leading Shiite Muslim cleric and his two sons in February, according to a UN investigator. Baghdad says Ayatollah Mohammad Sadiq al-Sadr was killed by elements, presumably Iranians, seeking to spread disunity in Iraq. And President Saddam Hussein's rule in Iraq has one of the bleakest human rights records of any country since the end of World War II. This, according to an investigator with the UN, Max van der Stoel, who has surveyed Iraq since 91, said the country's leadership systematically denies freedom of thought, expression, and association to its citizens. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Surrounded by dozens of off-duty police officers, as well as the parents and supporters of the man they killed, four white New York police officers were indicted yesterday on second-degree murder charges for the shooting death of Amadou Diallo, an unarmed Ghanaian immigrant who died last February 4th in the vestibule of his Bronx apartment building in a hail of 41 bullets. The officers, who belong to the city's controversial street crimes unit, pled not guilty to the charges and left the Bronx State Supreme Court after each posting $100,000 bail. Over 1,000 demonstrators stood outside the courtroom in a continuation of the protests that so far have led to over 1,200 arrests for civil disobedience. The daily demonstrations, organized by the Reverend Al Sharpton outside of police headquarters, have drawn thousands of people demanding the four officers be arrested. We now turn to yesterday's news conference in the Bronx, given by Bronx District Attorney Robert Johnson, who announced the indictments against the four police officers.
In the early morning hours of February 4th, 19 of 41 bullets fired at Amadou Diallo ripped into his body as he stood blameless, unarmed, and defenseless in the vestibule of his building. Today, after a seven-week investigation, I'm announcing that a Bronx grand jury has charged defendants Kenneth Boss, Sean Carroll, Edward McMillan, and Richard Murphy in a three-count indictment with intentional and reckless murder of Mr. Diallo by pistol shots and the reckless endangerment of those inside the building into which they fired. To ensure the fairness of any trial and to comply with my legal and ethical obligations, I have been constrained in what I have said for the last 7 weeks and what I will say here. Some comment is necessary, though, to promote public understanding about certain aspects of this case. Upon notification of the shooting, my staff responded immediately to the scene to conduct an investigation. From that moment and subsequently, with the particular assistance of the FBI, they worked tirelessly to gather the evidence necessary to determine the facts and circumstances of Mr. Diallo's horrific death. Numerous witnesses were interviewed, and extraordinary efforts were made to reconstruct the scene of that terrible event. However, some have asked why, as part of that investigation, my office did not question the four defendants, who are New York City police officers, about what happened to Mr. Diallo. Implicit in the question is the view that the officers, as public servants, should have to explain their actions. Of course, police officers have the same constitutional right to remain silent as anyone else, and the same privilege to an attorney. Thus, while my staff actually sought to speak with the officers on the morning of the shooting and thereafter about what occurred, we had no right to compel them to say anything at all. Similarly, while each had the opportunity to testify before the grand jury and to present an exculpatory version of the facts, the law is clear that no one can be compelled to testify without giving him complete immunity from prosecution. However, having chosen not to waive immunity and present their versions, these police officers cannot reasonably claim, as some have suggested, that their conduct should automatically be excused merely because they are police officers. They simply cannot have it both ways. Regarding the charges, the grand jury indicted defendants for 2 counts of murder in the second degree, the highest degree of murder legally applicable under the circumstances. The first count charges that the defendants acting together intentionally killed Mr. Diallo. This simply means that their conscious purpose at the moment they fired was to cause his death. Under New York law, it is not necessary for the prosecution to prove before the grand jury or at trial that the defendants had any particular motive for the killing or that they planned or premeditated it in any way. The second count basically charges that regardless of intent, the defendants recklessly caused Mr. Diallo's death under circumstances demonstrating a depraved indifference to human life. In a similar vein, the grand jury indicted the defendants for 1 count of reckless endangerment in the first degree. This count charges basically that the defendants also demonstrated a depraved indifference to the life of any person inside the building into which they were shooting, and that the shooting recklessly created a grave risk of any such person's death. If convicted of murder, the defendants face imprisonment for a maximum term of life. If convicted of reckless endangerment, they face imprisonment for a maximum term of 7 years. I recognize, as others do, that the death of Amadou Diallo has a context larger than the facts of this case. Feelings of fear and frustration abound. Troubling questions have been raised, particularly in communities of color, but certainly not limited to them, regarding police-community relations, civil liberties, and the issue of respect. Questions also have also been raised about public safety. All of us cherish the reduction in crime, and none of us wants it to go back up. These questions must be addressed. Certainly, we are in need of law and order, but we should not have to sacrifice the freedoms they are designed to protect. Let us be clear, however, that the indictment filed in this case involves charges against 4 individuals, and only those 4 individuals, for killing one unarmed person and jeopardizing others. As district attorney, that is the case I will prosecute as fairly, forcefully, and effectively as I can, respectful of my obligations to do justice.
That was Bronx District Attorney Robert Johnson announcing the second-degree murder indictments against officers Sean Carroll, Kenneth Boss, Edward McMillan. In addition, outside the courtroom, there were hundreds of police officers who were there to defend the 4 officers, along with Richard Murphy, who was the 4th officer, and the police officers held a news conference.
I'd like to thank the officers of New York City for their undaunted support and the members of the street crime. Stand your heads proud.
And I love my fellow brothers. That's it.
I appreciate the support that's been shown today. I'm not guilty of any crimes.
Murphy. I'm very happy with the support that we're getting from the police department. I did nothing wrong, and it's going to... I did nothing wrong, and this trial will show that I did nothing wrong, and I'm looking forward to it.
After the police officer spoke, one of their lawyers spoke.
And what really is a...
I absolutely feel that my client and these other officers are political prisoners. It's a regrettable day when officers on duty doing their job are charged with murder. The district attorney had the discretion to present any charge or no charge to the grand jury. He chose, unfortunately, to present a murder charge. It's totally inappropriate.
Now your client fell back and broke his tailbone in the process.
Yes, and I've... Yes, and we've said that from the beginning. The district attorney talked about, not hearing from them. We've said from the beginning that what happened here, these officers believe that Mr. Diallo had a gun. That's the only reason the shots were fired. He fell backwards. There's no question about that. He went to the hospital after that. There are medical records that indicate that. It's not an issue.
He fired first.
We're not going to talk about who fired first. The basic scenario of what took place is these officers on duty investigated Mr. DiGallo because he was acting suspiciously. During the course of that, they gave him certain instructions which Mr. DiGallo did not follow. Mr. DiGallo made certain actions and gestures which led these officers to believe that he was about to fire a weapon at them. As a result of those actions, they defended themselves and their brother officers, and they fired. Mr. DiGallo did not fall at any point during the incident, and that's why the number of shots that were fired were fired. That's the incident, and that's what the proof will show. Nothing else.
Trials, are you going to have a trial altogether? What is
it? That's why they kept firing?
He did not fall down. I mean, he remained standing during the entire incident.
Mr. Ward, the district attorney said in all of his years in law enforcement, he had never seen a case of this much force, and that's what led him to ask for no bail.
Well, with all due respect, the politics led the district attorney to ask for no bail. It's ridiculous. These officers surrendered this morning. Everyone in the city of New York has known that they were going to appear on a murder two indictment today, and they appeared. They're not going anywhere. We want our trial. We'll have our trial. They have jobs at stake. They have lives at stake. They have reputations at stake, and they intend to fight for all those things. They did nothing wrong. Police officers take guns off the street. Every now and then, a regrettable tragedy can happen. That's what happened here. No murder was committed. No crime was committed.
That was lawyer for one of the four police officers, again, charged with second-degree murder yesterday by Bronx District Attorney Robert Johnson in New York City. After those indictments were handed down and the police officers and those lawyers responded, the family of Amadou Diallo held a news conference along with their attorneys and supporters. We begin with the mother and father of Amadou Diallo.
Amadou's blood will feed the battle for justice for everyone in this life. And I salute Reverend Al. I thank all the people, all colors, all religions, because they have been given their commitment and they continue to do it. So I thank them for everything. And also I want to mention today that Reverend Al will be with us, with the family. We will swim or sink together. I salute his courage, and I thank him. I thank all of you. I'm sorry, I'm very tired. That's all I can say.
Thank you very much. We are happy to be here as a father of Amadou Diallo and a mother, and all our relatives and friends. We left here, we went to Guinea, we buried Amadou Diallo already in his homeland, besides our parents. So while we were there, we understand that this rally was continuing here, struggling to find justice for Amadou Diallo. This time we are here, together with you, to stand to see the justice is done. So we thank all the body. Everybody for the support. We understand so many people struggled, went to jail for this purpose.
That was the father and mother of Amadou Diallo, Saiku Ahmed and Kadiatou Diallo. They were standing with their attorneys, known as the Dream Team from the O.J. Simpson case of Los Angeles, Johnny Cochran, Peter Neufeld, and Barry Scheck. We begin with Johnny Cochran.
In what really is a very, very important day, I think history will show, in the history of the city of New York, the indictment of these four police officers on these three counts, we think is a signal day, and it bespeaks at least a start of justice and a leveling of the playing field in this community. The fact that there have been two counts of murder and one count of reckless endangerment because each of these officers, I think, speaks for itself. They are, in fact, presumed to be innocent until the contrary is proven, and of course, we want them to have a fair trial. But it is important, we think, from our standpoint and our representation of our clients, to set the record straight with regard to certain things and certain theories being floated and certain myths, if you will, being perpetrated on this community. We would be doing less than our job were we not to address that.
That was Johnny Cochran. When we come back from our break, Peter Neufeld and Barry Scheck. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! On the day after the second-degree murder indictments were handed down against four white New York City police officers for the shooting death of Amadou Diallo. Stay with us.
As many of you know,
you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. On this day after the second-degree murder indictments were handed down against four police officers in New York City in a case that has shocked the nation, Kenneth Boss, Richard Murphy, Edward McClellan, and another police officer were charged with second-degree murder for the killing of Amadou Diallo. We now go to the response. You've just heard from Johnny Cochran, the chief lawyer, and Peter Neufeld and Barry Scheck, well known again for their defense of O.J. Simpson, were at his side. This is Peter Neufeld responding to the second-degree murder indictments.
As many of you know, from the very beginning, we have been concerned with the fact that there was no effort made to interview, even informally, the four police officers who shot Mr. Diallo to death on that very evening when the shooting occurred. One reason we were very concerned with that is that it set up a situation whereby these officers, without making a statement themselves that they would have to live with later on, were able to float all kinds of trial balloons with you folks in the press and in the community without actually having to say it themselves. See what works before the evidence comes out. If the evidence comes out and it's different, they can always tailor it later on. We were very concerned with that, and already we've seen three different stories come out from the police officers, through their lawyers, through their associates. All of them are false, and as Mr. Cochran said, there will be more stories coming before trial begins. You all may recall the very first story in the days following the shooting when it was suggested that the only reason they all started firing is because bullets were ricocheting off the door, the wall, the floor, back at them, creating the appearance of bullets being fired in their direction. Indeed, one of them suggested in the press that a bullet had actually pierced through the pants leg of one of the four officers as further evidence of this ricocheting effect. Later on, they realized, as we all did, that there was no evidence of ricocheting at all in this case. They realized, as obviously the prosecutors have realized and everyone else has realized, there was no bullet hole that pierced through the pants leg of one of the officers. So that story went by the wayside, and we haven't heard that story anymore. Then we heard a second story about a week or two ago, floated by one of the lawyers for these four officers, when it was learned that Mr. Diallo had had some experiences with the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Then the lawyer suggested what happened here is that Mr. Diallo was fleeing from the police down Wheeler Avenue. And it was only after fleeing from the police and going into the vestibule that the shooting commenced. But there were no witnesses to support the notion that Mr. Diallo was fleeing down the street. And so that story, too, went by the wayside. And lately, in the last day, we've seen in two newspapers a new version. The new version says that it was necessary to fire all these shots because when they started shooting at Mr. Diallo, he did not fall to the ground. He became somewhat hunched over. He went down into a crouch, but he never fell to the ground. That is an absurd assertion, and I assure you that they will soon be putting that one aside as well. What we have learned from our own investigation and from the help of our own pathologist, who has done a second autopsy in this case, is that two of the earliest bullets fired at Mr. Diallo perforated his spine. One up here and a second one down here. When those bullets, and at least one of them, perforated the spine, he was instantly paralyzed, unable to stand anymore at all. He was not hunched over, he was not crouched over, he was brought down to the ground immediately. Secondly, contrary to their assertion that all these shots were fired while he is standing up and refusing to go down, our pathologist has determined, at least preliminarily, that there are several shots that are consistent with Mr. Diallo lying on the ground and being shot. Three of the shots seem to be consistent with that, and one bullet has no explanation other than that. And so when these people, through either friendly reporters or associates in the PBA or in the police department, start floating these stories, the reason they're able to do it is because we have this system where police officers are not questioned promptly about their activities. Thank you.
That was attorney Peter Neufeld, followed by Barry Scheck, also an attorney for the Giallo family, responding to the second-degree murder indictments handed down against four white New York City police officers who shot and killed Amadou Diallo. Barry Scheck.
I'd like to reiterate what Johnny said at the very beginning of this press conference, and that is that we want to see justice. We want to see a fair trial. These defendants are presumed innocent, but in the press statement that Rob Johnson issued, he made a very important point with respect to, on the one hand, the constitutional right to remain silent and even choose not to testify in front of the grand jury, and on the other hand, the fact that these officers have given no explanation of their conduct. The key point for us, certainly in pursuing civil litigation, certainly in pursuing relief, whether it be through us as civil litigants or the federal government in their pattern and practice litigation, is why is it in New York City that police officers are not asked a simple question by other police officers that arrive at the scene? And that simple question is, what happened? These officers were not asked that question, it appears, and gave no explanation. That 48-hour rule and the other rules that are in place in New York City that are not in existence in any other major metropolitan area in America is what puts the district attorney's office and anyone wants to pursue these kinds of cases in a very difficult position. That question simply should have been asked to these officers, and it wasn't. And the entire method of investigation has to change. The entire focus of the investigation at the scene was not what happened. Let's get an explanation for how these shots were fired. The focus was, what can we find out about Amadou Diallo that is negative? And it's a story that's been broken before. It deserves reexamination. I feel certain that federal and state authorities are going to look into it, and you should be looking into it. The roommates were pulled from their apartment. They were not told who fired these shots that killed Amadou. They were brought down to the precinct. They were each separated. They were interrogated at least four times each, and they were asked, what can you tell us that's wrong about Amadou Diallo? Who are the enemies that might do this to him? What bad stuff can you tell us? And the entire focus was on negative information about the victim, and not the one simple question of the police officers was asked, what happened? And Commissioner Safer and Mayor Giuliani have to change this system, whereby the worst officers are insulated from swift and effective investigation by a set of rules that exists in no other city.
Thank you, Barry Scheck. You've now heard from the members of the legal team. We will be the team in place to move forward, as I said, to represent these clients in the civil litigation. We'll be vigorous. We will be relentless in our pursuit of justice. Collectively, we believe in this case. We believe this is a tragic wrong, and we see this wrong as being endemic of a problem throughout the United States.
This is Johnny Cochran, the lead attorney in the Amadou Diallo case.
It now becomes my pleasure to bring before you now a man who perhaps has done more in the last 5 or 6 weeks to change the landscape of New York than any person perhaps in the last 15 or 20 years. Make no mistake about it, Reverend Al Sharpton has been the leader of trying to bring justice for the Diallo family. When they reached out to him, he promised them that he would not rest until some justice or measure of justice were brought to their son. Their son had not died in vain. We on the legal team have marveled at his strategy, at his collective wisdom, in bringing a broad base of New Yorkers to bear on this issue. We've seen civil disobedience here, which brought us to mind, those of us who are old enough, of the 1960s. We've seen insensitive politicians made to take notice. This is an issue that galvanizes not only the black and brown communities, but communities across this country, because what happened out there in the Bronx was absolutely wrong. So that it affords me a great deal of pleasure, and to say again the great amount of respect and admiration I have for the Reverend Al Sharpton, who else could bring Susan Sarandon and so many people, lawyers, doctors, ministers, to find themselves arrested up there in the Bronx for a cause they believe so strongly in, other than Reverend Al Sharpton, who will now come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Cochran, to the legal team. Certainly we are happy that they have laid out the case. I remind the media at the outset, several weeks ago, the city father said, "Don't you trust Bob Johnson? Don't you respect the grand jury?" Well, today Bob Johnson spoke. The grand jury spoke. Two counts of murder in the second degree. I asked the mayor and police commissioner, but they asked me, "Don't you trust Bob Johnson? Don't you trust the grand jury?" The PBA is saying, "Don't rush to judgment." Yet they're saying that these men are not guilty of a crime. Sounds like a judgment to me. Sounds like they've rushed to some conclusion to me. It is clear that in this city, those that would dare question for police are accused of questioning all police, even when policemen have committed civil disobedience with us. Has it escaped those of you in the media that the former chief of patrol, William Bracey, went to jail? That a former inspector and a former lieutenant went to jail? Are they anti-cop? Are they cop bashing? For us to see hundreds of policemen defend four police who hasn't even told their story tells you why people are so frightened and threatened by a police psychology that is going on in this city. Clearly, we had the right to raise questions on these four police, and the indictment vindicates our suspicion. It does not clearly conclude or convict them. But clearly, this grand jury did not even go for manslaughter. They didn't even go for the escape route. They went for murder, which clearly is a statement unto itself. And when our preliminary autopsies showed that not only was Amadou not standing up because his spine was severed, but he was hit in the lower extremities of his body, for his lawyers, the defendant's lawyers, to stand in court today and malign and in many ways demonize Bob Johnson, who just 5 weeks ago they were telling us to trust, and how he was a great prosecutor, and how the whole city should just wait on Honest Bob. Well, Honest Bob came back today and ended up guilty of having political prisoners, bowing to political pressure. I mean, I'm sure he was shocked to see the people that were defending him flip the script on him in 2 seconds flat. More importantly, it says to this city how disingenuous they were in the first place. This movement that has emanated in this case is unparalleled. More people showed courage here across lines than we've seen in a long time, if ever. I've never seen, even in the Free South Africa movement, 1,200 people go to jail in 15 days. And then the span of people and the different types of people. This case has brought out New York at its best and New York at its worst. At its best, blacks and whites and Jews and Gentiles and famous and those that are unknown went to jail. At its worst, our children saw hundreds of cops mob four men indicted for murder today. What message does these off-duty cops give children when you can walk out of a courtroom indicted for murder and be mobbed by people who tomorrow will be on duty? Even if they think that they made a mistake, are they celebrities? Are they heroes? Are they modest? It is absolutely insulting to the intelligence of this city to try and raise them to that status, even if you believe they made a mistake. We saw the city at its best when we saw ex-mayors and political figures become accountable to the wishes of the people. We saw it at its worst when we see a present northern mayor lips drip with the words of interposition and nullification, and every chance he get, try and demean people's right to stand up, calling nonviolent protests silly, saying that people were getting arrested as a publicity stunt. But then when signs are held up, he equates a sign that he feels wrongly identifies him with the life of a human being. He says we ought to tell people to lower signs, while he tells cops to stop killing people. Like, that's a fast change, a protest sign for human life. That doesn't fit in the scales of what justice should be about. We saw the city at its best when we saw those of us that used to not even speak spend days riding in police wagons to precincts. We saw it at its worst when we see two men trying to become the new PBA president compete with each other on beating up on protesters to try to win a union election, and now even come with a questionable slogan, no justice, no police. Well, the mayor ought to ask them, does that mean if they don't get the outcome they want at trial, if there's going to be a police strike in New York? Are they saying now if they don't get what they call justice, that we can't expect policing? And then we're accused of politicizing a trial when we are hearing policemen threaten the city of New York? I think that we cannot tolerate. We intend to continue in this struggle. We intend to stay out in front of the Bronx courthouse. We intend to escalate. Tomorrow morning, the parents and I will be having breakfast with 200 community leaders, union leaders, and politicians, planning for all-out struggles. There will be a huge march here on the 15th. Next Tuesday, the parents and I will be meeting with Cardinal O'Connor at his office. Next Saturday, they will be meeting with Reverend Jesse Jackson. This is not the end. This is the beginning. We intend to nationalize this fight, and we intend to use this case as a case to show this nation and the world that people can come together for justice. I went to Guinea with the mother and father, the Barry Amadou. I promised her father, I promised his relatives in the village that I would come back one day, that I would come back and show them we got the murderers arrested and that we got justice by getting them convicted. I'm prepared to make good on half that promise today, but the other half is still outstanding. I intend to clear up that debt and go home with them one day and report to that village, my village, because I'm now Al Sharpton Diallo.
Thank you very much.
That was the Reverend Al Sharpton speaking along with the legal team for the family of Amadou Diallo. He died on February 4th when four white police officers in New York fired 41 bullets at him, 19 killing him. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! The second-degree murder indictments were handed down against the four officers yesterday in New York. Also yesterday in New York, a major gathering took place. Over 3,000 people packed into the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, which is the largest Gothic cathedral in the world. It's in Manhattan. They gathered for the funeral of Samori Marksman, the beloved program director of Pacifica Station WBAI. Samori died early last Tuesday, March 23rd. He left behind his wife, Rita, his two daughters, Lindy Way and Zinzi, and a son, Kaifa, as well as brother and sisters. Samori also left behind a large extended family. For many of us who knew him, and especially those who work here at WBAI in New York, Samori has been a mentor, a leader, and a friend. Born in the Caribbean island of St. Vincent, he became a citizen of the world. He was a Pan-Africanist and also understood the links between the struggle of working people everywhere. Samori was a longtime supporter of human rights and the international peace movement. He traveled extensively and struck up friendships with activists, intellectuals, and leaders in Africa, the Middle East, Asia, and the Caribbean, Latin America, and Europe. Upon learning of Samori's unexpected death, dying at the age of 51, Janet Jagan, the president of Guyana, halted a cabinet session last week to talk about Samori.
It was with deep sorrow that I just learned of the unexpected death of Samori Marksman. The late President Chetty Jagan and I always regarded Samori as a courageous, advanced thinker and activist of liberation, equality, and progress for the persecuted, the discriminated, and the poor on our earth. He lived a useful life, and his many contributions should be respected and appreciated. My sincerest sympathy to his family, close friends, and associates.
That was the president of Guyana, Janet Jagan, upon learning of Samori's death. And yesterday at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, in addition to the thousands of people that crowded in, There were messages of condolence and support from around the world.
From all over the world, acknowledgement of Samori Marksman. From the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Cuba, a message of condolence.
I bring greetings from the Working People's Alliance of Guyana, on whose executive committee I have the honor to serve.
From the Socialist Republic of Vietnam.
This is from Dr. Terence Marichaux, political leader of the Maurice Bishop Patriotic Movement in Grenada.
From Bernadette Devlin McCallisky, freedom fighter in Ireland.
From Errol MacLeod, President General of the Oilfield Workers' Trade Union of Trinidad and Tobago.
Just some of the people who and organizations sent messages of support upon hearing of the death of Samori Marksman. When we come back from our break, we'll hear Samori himself and some of the interviews he's done over the years and talk more about this great man. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, as today we remember a great warrior, Samori Marksman, or as we often called him, Samurai. Samurai, the intellectual warrior, the word warrior. Samori was a very important man in my development and experience in radio. I came to Pacifica Station WBAI 14 years ago, and Samori had already been there for many years, had been here for more than two decades. Samori, for me, was a friend, a mentor, a colleague. Walking into his office, now, mind you, he's an administrator. He's the program director. He'd call me in under the ruse of scheduling or programming, and then he'd talk about the world, about history. He'd talk about the Caribbean and Africa. He introduced me to the great leaders of different areas of the world, the Senegalese scientist Cheikh Anta Diop, the great writer Frantz Fanon. He told me about Walter Rodney and how Europe underdeveloped Africa. He talked about John Henrik Clark, the historian, and introduced me to all of their worlds of thought. Samori had a show as well on WBAI Pacifica Station, and that show was called Worldview, and it ran every afternoon at 5 o'clock. Just before he died, he did an interview with British parliamentarian Tony Benn about the situation in Kosovo.
And good afternoon once again. Do thank you for joining us this afternoon here on WBAI in New York City, non-commercial listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM for this edition of Behind the News, during which we look at significant national and international economic, political, and social developments. And as always, we try to show how these issues influence our lives right here within the National Conference of the United States of America. Today, we will be following up on the question of Kosovo. Joining us now, though, is Tony Benn, who is speaking with us from London. I believe he is at Parliament now. How are you, Tony? How are you? Thanks for joining us today.
I'm fine. We're voting, and there may be another vote. If the bell rings, you'll know where I've gone. Okay. We're talking about Kosovo.
If the bell rings for you, for whom the bell shall toll.
Samori talking to Tony Benn, and just a day after he talked to Tony Benn, Tony Benn learned of Samori's death and responded.
Over the years, which goes back, I think my diary says that the first time I spoke to him was February 1987. That's 12 years back. I've met him in London. I've met him in New York. I've done, I should think, dozens of radio programs with him. And there's not an issue that we haven't discussed: the Gulf War, elections in America and Britain, the Berlin Wall coming down, Kosovo, Iraq, NATO, new Labour government. And I always found him a perfect media man. And I say that as a tribute. He didn't try to obtrude his own views or dominate. He wanted to know what you thought. And he always had helpful and useful questions to bring it out. In such a way that made the discussion a pleasure. And I used to say to him regularly at the end of the program how what I felt about his capacities. But what he did was to deal with issues that other media stations didn't deal with. That was one thing. He brought out questions, issues, arguments that would otherwise not have been heard. He never confrontational in his way of discussion. He always wanted to know and to listen and to encourage people to say what they wanted to say. He always provided lots of time, which makes all the difference. It wasn't the sound bite and thank you very much and ring off. It was an opportunity to discuss things in depth. And there must be many, many people who listen to WBAI and Pacifica who've heard him and know the quality of the man and will miss him, as I will, very, very much.
That was British parliamentarian Tony Benn learning of Samori Marksman's death. Samori was a great intellect and also extremely humorous and often talked about the world and people in ways that you wouldn't expect.
No elected official has the courage to stand up and say, I'm a socialist or I'm an anti-imperialist. In fact, the last person of prominence to declare that they were an anti-imperialist was Mark Twain. And that's when they officially declared him crazy. But the point I make is that there's a certain kind of mindset in the society where people are afraid to utter certain words like imperialism, you know, and like capitalism is rotten. Of course, we talk about the economy is rotten and the social problems which are engendered by a rotten economy in the inner cities, etc. But nobody talks about the system itself.
Samori Marksman in an interview in 1995 with filmmaker Kevin Keating, who was doing a film on Cuba. But Samori, whatever he talked about, couldn't just talk about the particular country or that year or that decade. He goes back centuries and forward and travels around the world. This continuation of that interview.
Well, if I may, I think before we get into anything, there are three basic things I'd like to us to focus on in terms of understanding Cuba and where Cuba is. That Cuba is, number one, what one may call a poor, developing, so-called third world country. It fits in that general category. Granted, in many aspects of life and health and so on, it's much better off. But I think it's important to locate Cuba into proper global perspective and context whenever we talk about it. I think we should also keep in mind that when discussing Cuba-U.S. relations, that Cuba really, the relations that Cuba has had with countries such as the Soviet Union, which ostensibly is what the U.S. used as a basis for maintaining the kind of relationship that it has with Cuba, that it wasn't the Communist Party, you know, the Communist government of Cuba that established those relations. It's important to remember that it was in 1943 that the Batista regime established relations with the Soviet Union. Why? Because the Soviet Union was then allied with the United States against Nazi Germany, and Batista was instructed to recognize the local Communist Party within Cuba, and that ultimately led to relations with the Soviet Union. So that 16 years before the triumph of the revolution, we had what one may call state-to-state relations between Cuba and the Soviet Union. So we can't blame that on Castro as such.
I think the first thing that we must keep in mind is that while the U.S. does claim and has claimed that the reason for, in essence, applying pressure to Cuba politically, diplomatically, militarily, economically, particularly, is because Cuba was a Soviet outpost, a communist beachhead in the West, that in actuality, that we could go back over a century to find examples and chronicle examples of U.S. interference and intervention in Cuba. So that to answer your question, we might want to begin roughly around 1826. We could go back further, but I think that was the most significant point of departure, in that in 1826 at the Panama Conference, when Simon Bolivar and others were debating the question of helping to emancipate all of the Americas to smash slavery in the entire region, that the U.S. intervened and, in fact, threatened. In fact, Secretary of State Clay at the time suggested to the Cubans that, listen, we would perhaps consider your attempt to attain independence for Cuba. However, if that meant, or if that would mean the emancipation of the Africans, the slaves, then we couldn't possibly accept that at all. Now, this is happening against the backdrop of the infamous, or famous, if you will, Monroe Doctrine, which was signed only or declared only 3 years before that, 1823. So we had, if we go back that far, and we see we had a direct big stick approach to what's determining what Cuba's own role would be as a sovereign state, a potential sovereign state, but also to dictate to the countries of the Caribbean how and which direction it ought to go. I need not tell you what the U.S.'s reaction was to the Haitian Revolution, which occurred only a few years earlier, and that it maintained that same hostility towards other countries of the Caribbean. And for several years after that, there's been one intervention after another, the most famous or historically significant being 1898 with the so-called Spanish-American War. And once again, we need to keep in focus that these things occurred several decades before the Bolshevik Revolution triumphed in Russia in 1917. So the notion that the intervention against Cuba had to do with communism is, you know, it's a farce. So now, as far as the recent history, we could look at what happened in the 1940s. I alluded to the recognition of the Soviet Union by the Batista regime, which had to do with global, the balance of forces in the world at that time and the shifting of alliances with the Soviet Union aligned with the West, etc. Conversely, there was an opportunity for the United States to gain infinitely greater control in the Caribbean. For example, so that we found that in Jamaica, in Trinidad and Tobago, in Antigua, we found that the United States had entered into relations through the British government to gain control of military facilities on those islands and in other islands as well, because it had now begun to supplant Britain as the major naval power and military power in that hemisphere, even though most of those territories, or many of those territories, were in fact British colonies. In 1958, when the West Indian Federation was established, we found that many of the people who were involved in that movement, many of the social democrats, including people such as Michael Manley's father and people like Bustamante, people like Errol Barrow, who would later figure in the Cuban Angola project very significantly.
Samori Marksman speaking in 1995 for a film interview on Cuba. Samori again died last week, March 23rd, of a massive heart attack. He was 51 years old. Now, regular listeners to Democracy Now! May remember his presence on Democracy Now! Just a few months ago. In fact, it was another sad time. It was a time where we were remembering Kwame Ture, formerly Stokely Carmichael, and Samori was a friend of his. And, well, I interviewed Samori. I wanted to move forward a little bit from his days as a SNCC member, then as a Black Panther, to his life in Africa. Samori Marksman was a good friend of his there in Africa, both in Guinea and Liberia. Samori, program director at Pacifica Radio's WBAI here in New York, and came to spend a good deal of time with him from 1973 through 1978 when Samori was living in Africa. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Samori.
Thank you very much for allowing me on Pacifica Radio.
Well, good to have you. Tell us about those years in Guinea and Liberia.
Kwame Ture arrived at what I consider to be a sort of an ideological zenith,
which is where many Africans from across the world ultimately settle, if you will. There are people like Malcolm X ultimately approach the point of Pan-Africanism. People like George Padmore, of course, arrived at that point. People like Walter Rodney, people like, even Paul Robeson, many others, arrive at that point of ideological attainment. And certainly Kwame Ture came from the civil rights struggle, from black nationalism, and arrived at the point of Pan-Africanism, revolutionary Pan-Africanism. But he arrived there not simply in a philosophical way, but along clear ideological, articulating clear ideological points. He was anti-imperialist. He was anti-capitalist. He was a socialist. And the same kind of defiance which Michael alluded to earlier, in that he never feared actually advancing these sort of ideas. He argued for scientific socialism in Africa. And he arrived at the point of recognizing the contributions of people like Marx and Engels and Lenin, and pointed to that as an incorporation of what he believed in the overall context of Pan-Africanism. And as such, I found a joy talking with him. And we spent a lot of time arguing. In fact, we had a house that was on the beach, and it had a rooftop. So we used to sit in Liberia. And if you ever listen to Coltrane in your life, if you sit on the shores of the Atlantic Ocean listening to Coltrane in the background arguing with Kwame Ture, you can't describe that as such. But we spent a lot of time debating what part of Trinidad are you from. How much pepper you should have in your rice and peas.
Now, at that time, in the early 70s, was he married to Maryam Makeba?
Yes, she was. And, in fact, she spent a lot of time at that point in Liberia, even though another home she had was in Guinea. So, actually, they commuted a lot between Guinea and Liberia. Obviously, both countries are side by side. And we spent a lot of time debating ideological points. In fact, a lot of debates at that point was over China and Soviet Union, whether or not one should accept the sort of ideological guidance from the Russians or from the Chinese. And a lot of our debate was around that. It was at a point, of course, when there was a struggle raging in southern Africa, and one pretty much had to make a decision, if you will, an ideological decision as to where one came down on questions of Angola, of Mozambique, etc. And many of our discussions are centered around that. And invariably, he always upheld, even when we may have disagreed on fine ideological points, clearly his commitment to anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist, and pro-Pan-Africanist ideas were unquestionable. And I think that's what I sort of got from my experience with him in that brief period in Guinea.
Now, as we said at the beginning of the show, Samori Marksman speaking just a few months ago on Democracy Now!, and who would have guessed? We were all stunned in the early morning of March 23rd when we learned the news that our dear colleague, program director, friend, mentor would leave us so soon. Samori Marksman, 1947 to 1999, survived by his wife, his three children, and the greater WBAI and Pacifica family. Well, that does it for today's program. Special thanks to Bernard White, David Sears, and Walter Krockmal. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Today we're going to go out with the dub poetry of Linton Kwesi Johnson, another man that Samori Marksman introduced me to. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
I was wondering if I could shape this passion just as I wanted in solid fire. I was wondering if the strange combustion of my days, the tension of the world inside of me, and the strength of my heart were enough. I was wondering if I could stand as tall while the tide of the sea rose and fell. If the sky would recede as I went, or the earth would emerge as I came, to the door of the morning knocked against me.